This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop. Record salmon counts in West Vancouver are a result of the atmospheric river, says a local stream keeper. Danny Nesvarani at CJSF in Burnaby has that story. Glaciologist Dr. Brian Nunes, a professor at UNBC's geography program, took part in a global study measuring global glacier loss, which revealed significant ice melt. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio in Prince George has more. Local festivals are calling for renewal of the BC Festival Fund. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo will bring us that story. And in Smithers, Project 529 aims to save Smithers bikes this year. Pam Hassan at CICK News dives in. Stay with us.
Reporting from West Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. In October of 2024, the Lower Mainland experienced an atmospheric river, a long, narrow section in the atmosphere that transports water vapor outside of the tropics. The severity of this atmospheric river resulted in significant precipitation levels, infrastructure damage from flooding, and according to findings from the West Vancouver Streamkeeper Society, historically high counts for local salmon populations. On February 24, 2025, the organization presented findings from their yearly salmon count at West Vancouver City Council, where they stated that the atmospheric river event in October had actually proven to be a benefit for local salmon populations. To learn more about these findings, CJSF met with Leslie Pomeroy, a lead volunteer for the West Vancouver Streamkeeper Society, who is also responsible for the organization's student volunteer programs. We spoke at Brothers Creek in West Vancouver, where these high salmon counts were first observed.
It was really interesting. So I don't know if you remember, but the atmospheric river happened on voting day. And I was out helping with a campaign, and I was with somebody who's actually an MP in West Vancouver, and she was getting all these texts of floods, massive floods. I can't remember exactly, but it was down 21st and 25th. There were just rivers. And then Marine Drive was underwater. A bunch of businesses were damaged. And I had a survey. My team was supposed to go out on the Sunday. And the girls were wondering if we should cancel. And I said, no, we're not canceling. This is an amazing opportunity to see the effects, the firsthand effects of climate change on our creeks. So I was basically preparing it to be a lesson in, yeah, the devastation of climate change. I sort of prefaced it with, we're not going to see any fish, but we can see what has happened to the creeks as a result of the really extraordinarily high water levels. And sure enough, we did see a lot of, there was a bit of erosion, not a ton, but just, you know, the water had to find new channels down the creek and things like that. And we did several, we have five zones, and we got to here, this was our final zone, and we actually saw three chum in the creek. And the water was still running incredibly fast. I don't know how they stayed in the creek or if they somehow got back up the following day. But it was, we'd had quite a few fish prior to then. The fish numbers dropped dramatically after the atmospheric river, but within, you know, a week, they were way high. So I would say that the main benefit for salmon was just the high water levels. It makes it so much easier to move up the creek. And we've had, I mean, as you know, we've had several years of drought for Vancouver. When the water levels are high, I mean, you can see over here where you've got lots of rock. If you don't have a lot of water, they simply can't move up the creek.
Pomeroy also spoke about the initial surprise that came from the salmon count due to the negative human effects of the atmospheric river.
Because we view the atmospheric river from a very human point of view, which is like, oh, there's so much water, it's going to be hard to get up the creek. But it, in fact, is a completely different experience for the salmon. I think we were also really surprised because the chum predictions were extremely low. Like, they thought we were going to have a very bad year for chum, and we ended up having a huge year. And so within the first week we saw fish, second week we only saw three, but then the next week people just started reporting massive numbers of fish in the creeks. So yes, it was surprising. What was also surprising was that, human devastation aside, it proved to be a wonderful refresh for the creek, because we've had so many years of relatively low water flow, so you don't get a lot of redistribution of gravel. Erosion is actually kind of good for the creeks because it gets gravel in to the creeks, and that's the ideal spawning material for the salmon. Yeah, and that was unanticipated by us, but of course, in retrospect, makes perfect sense.
Lastly, Leslie Pomeroy talked about what people should do if they want to become more involved with their local creeks and ecosystems.
What I love about the streams is they give you an insight to one aspect of the environment, but one that affects everything around it and is affected by everything around it. So, yeah, if we have healthy streams, it's likely to be reflective of a healthier environment, which I'm sure even if human beings don't care about salmon and don't care about streams, they probably care about, you know, the health of their own environment. Yeah, that's another thing. And West Vancouver Stream Keepers is a great organization. We have a website that I would encourage anybody who's interested in going and having a look at, but also look into streamkeeping organizations in your own neighborhoods. Always looking for volunteers. I'm pretty certain all of them are always looking for volunteers. And yeah, there's lots of opportunity to get out and get in the creeks and enjoy nature.
Once again, that was Leslie Pomeroy of the West Vancouver Stream Keepers Society. You can learn more about the West Vancouver Stream Keepers Society on westvancouverstreamkeepers.ca. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
When we think about the end of this century, by and large, most of the ice in the Fraser Basin will be gone.
That's according to a new study by Dr. Brian Manunis, glaciologist based at the University of Northern British Columbia. In the Department of Geography, Earth, and Environmental Sciences, or GEES, or GEES.
And also working right now for the federal government, Natural Resources Canada, Geological Survey of Canada.
He has recently participated in a study providing a comprehensive assessment of worldwide glacier mass loss between the year 2000 and 2023.
Well, this particular study, I'm one of many, many authors, and it really is the summary of a workshop and a intercomparison exercise by glaciologists worldwide to better understand how much and where and how quickly glaciers are disappearing and melting from Earth's mountains. There have been a number of studies, recent and a benchmark one in 2015, which really looked at the projected loss of glaciers. So, and those earlier papers clearly show, unfortunately, that glaciers are not long for our world, especially those small ones. When we think about the end of this century, by and large, most of the ice in the Fraser Basin will be gone. In Western Canada, for example, over the 23-year period, we've lost about 23%, so about 1% per year. That has not been uniform. There are some years where we lose much more. But we're really starting with a smaller amount of ice, and these are really small glaciers, relatively small, compared to some of the large, truly large ice fields in the Northern Coast Mountains, the St. Elias. Even under very high emission scenarios, those areas will continue to have perhaps one half of the remaining ice. If we were, for example, to compare to the ice in Arctic Canada. But collectively, Canada is home to nearly one quarter of Earth's ice.
That's significant.
Unfortunately for us, however, because the glaciers are small in the Fraser Basin, they're not really expected to be around by the end of this century. And that has implications, not just for buffering capacity as seasonal snow has been depleted, but rather it's also a part of our legacy and part of our cultural, if you will, identity. You know, when I first moved to British Columbia, I fell in love with the mountains simply because they were ice clad and beautiful, beautiful glaciers.
And there's a reasonable chance that it just might not be like that anymore in the relatively near future, if we're looking at a timescale of thousands of years. Certainly, this is a lot closer than far away.
This is by the end of this century, so that's not thousands, that's 80 years, less than 80, which is quite worrisome, to say the least.
Overall, there is a net loss.
Sadly, there's a net loss. And for this particular study, if we took all of the ice, converted it to water, then over that 23-year period, it's accounted for about 1.8 centimeters of sea level rise. And to think of it in another way,
okay.
So corresponds to 276, I think, I can't remember, 70-something gigatons of mass change per year. And that's kind of a hard number to visualize. But one gigaton is 1 billion cubic meters. So imagine a billion full-size pickup trucks with their backs filled with water. That's about a cubic meter. So each year we're losing 273 billion of those per year.
It's incredible. Throughout the media we've consumed in pop culture over our lives, people may generally think of this affecting coastal areas and maybe a future where we all become pseudo-pirates like in James Cameron's Waterworld or something like that. But are there implications more locally in our own region of central interior BC that you could perhaps illustrate?
Mm-hmm. So in addition to sea level rise, so this particular study and others before it have really shown first with respect to sea level that melting glaciers right now represent the second largest component responsible for sea level rise. So this is larger right now than the Greenland melt from the Greenland ice sheet. It's substantially larger than the Antarctic ice sheet, but it's not as large as the sea level rise component due to thermal expansion of water. So as you heat up water and the Earth has gotten warmer, you allow that water to accommodate more volume, and as a result, that's causing sea levels to rise. But back to BC, why do glaciers matter? These are important natural resources that in many times are supplementing our headwater streams when seasonal snow is at a minimum or is melted away. Also during times of drought, these glaciers kick in and allow cool, plentiful water to exist in many of these streams. And it's really important for aquatic ecosystems. In some cases, in some of the watersheds that drain into Alberta, they do represent important freshwater flow for human consumption and agriculture. And also in some cases, for some of our watersheds, the melt from glaciers is responsible or helps to supplement clean energy, so hydropower generation.
So we're looking at locally in our region, certainly something like salmon stocks could be affected, steelhead, the river ecology could certainly be affected by this. Mm-hmm. And electricity, something we all depend on, is another big factor in our day-to-day lives that could dramatically affect it.
That's right. And there's also another component, and that is the changes in geohazards. So as we have our mountains becoming deglacierized, we are actually exposing steeply sloped terrain, which is sometimes unfortunately susceptible to landslides. And so this can occur largely through a concept referred to as debuttressing. Mm-hmm. So as we have a glaciated valley that becomes ice-free, you're setting up steep terrain, which is susceptible to failure. And those landslides can sometimes enter a standing body of water, and that can cause what's called an outburst flood. In some cases, we may also get small surficial lakes forming on top of glaciers, adjacent to the margins. And these can sometimes drain underneath the ice. And we had a particular event happen in Pemberton, outside of Pemberton last July. And that was an event that fortunately did not kill anyone, but was responsible for mobilizing sediment in a channel, causing a type of landslide called a debris flow, and also impacted downstream agricultural land, but also some footbridges as well.
If we're looking at our lives here in central interior, northern BC, a time period of within this century that we might not be seeing glaciers in our landscape, what kind of changes are you thinking we may experience within our world that as we know it here in Prince George? Do you think our way of life may change to the extent that we might all be having different jobs? We might all be doing completely different things because we have to adapt to a very different world.
Lots of questions there and lots of implications. There's no question that climate change and rising temperatures induced and primarily driven by rising greenhouse gas emissions have altered the climate that we're seeing, and they will continue to alter the climate going forward. This has implications not just for glaciers and sea level rise. You know, don't forget the contribution from glaciers continues to decrease. We'll start to get a larger component from the ice sheets such as Greenland. And that's a bit worrisome because there is a substantial sea level rise potential of the Greenland ice sheet. It's not going to melt next year, and it's not going to melt entirely within 100 years. But the contribution as we get towards the end of the century will be larger and larger. So the consequences of sea level rise will create conditions where it will cost more people to mitigate and protect against coastal erosion, against rising waters due to flooding. And so that has implications for everyone's insurance. Think, for example, of what just happened in California. Those fires, the fires that we've had in Jasper, the fires that we continue to have year after year in British Columbia, these are increasing costs of insurance. And so climate change is having a profound effect on everyone's way of life, whether you're a forester, whether you're a glaciologist, whether you're just simply listening to this program in Prince George. It will affect everyone, and it continues to affect everyone.
The nice thing about this research is that it's not necessarily behind a paywall. Where can people access your research and your findings? How can we read about
it? A number of ways. I always encourage interested public to reach out and contact me. You could certainly contact me at the university. If you're a sharp, aspiring, interested student, come work with us. Come talk to us. You can certainly download a copy of the Glamby paper, but you can also certainly contact me or contact anyone in GEES for information about snow and ice.
Can't do this work alone.
Always looking for sharp, talented students.
Thanks so much for your time with us in studio today, Brian. I really appreciate it.
No, it was a lot of fun.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you wish I had asked?
My favorite karaoke song?
Yeah, definitely.
Copacabana.
Nice. That's a good one. A good one.
That's about it.
Right on. I'm working on my Chris Stapleton voice. It's not going very well. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHY News Update. For 20 years, the Nanaimo Blues Festival has been bringing international and local blues music to Nanaimo's backyard. But right now, they are wondering why provincial funding has not been renewed for an important fund. Every second weekend in August, the Nanaimo Blues Festival takes over downtown Nanaimo for a four-day-long blues music festival. For the last 2 years, the festival has relied on the BC Fairs, Festivals, and Event Fund to fund headlining artists and keep the festival going. But as Jackie Moisen, president of the Nanaimo Blues Society, tells CHY, she's concerned that the funding has not been renewed for this year. The BC Fairs, Festivals, and Event Fund, or BCFFE Fund, was first created in 2001 by the BC government to support arts, culture, and sports events during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2021, the fund supported over 680 events that have grown to support over 1,000 in 2024. In 2024, 20 Nanaimo festivals and events received funding from the fund, including VIX, the Canada Day Celebration, and the Infringing Dance Festival. Last year, the Nanaimo Blues Festival received over $18,000. Moisen says without the funding, it would affect how the festival can run in the coming years.
It makes a difference between a year end of a deficit or a break even to a year end of a little bit of revenue in the account. And it's so important that when you're running the festival that, I mean, obviously no one wants to run a deficit because that could make the difference between the festival coming back the following year.
She explains the festival is also funded through the City of Nanaimo and the BC Arts Council, but the money they receive from the BC FFE fund helps keep the budget above water and helps them get started on the following year.
We have to start thinking about our next year festival quite early because with many of your headliners and touring artists, they're booking tours months and months in advance. So you really can't wait till the spring of the festival year to start looking at your headliners. You've got to start doing that in the fall.
Moisen says if the funding is not renewed, it will not affect this year's festival, but they will have to look at changing how they set up the festival in 2026. This could include hiring cheaper headliners, having a smaller advertising budget, and looking at lowering the amount of dates they run the festival. Moisen explains that usually the BCFF fund would open up applications in January, with the deadline to apply to be around the last week of February or the first week of March. As there hasn't been a call out for funding yet, the Nanaimo Blues Festival has joined a campaign with the BC Music Festival Collective, signing an open letter to the province seeking the urgent renewal of the BCFFE fund.
I mean, a lot of festivals, ours included, really need that funding to be viable. And if that funding is not going to happen this year, I don't know what to say. There's been no call out for it, kind of no word on whether that funding's going to occur. So I guess it's looking like a bit of a pause at this point. And I'm really hopeful that the advocacy going on across the province is going to make a difference.
Moisen says this comes as the post-pandemic cost of living and inflation has hit festivals and events across the province as the price of goods and services rise.
We had no live events for 2 years. We did a couple of virtual things, but no income, no revenue sources. So it's been a slow crawl back from post-COVID.
CHY reached out to the Ministry of Tourism, Arts, Culture and Sport about the BC Fairs, Festivals and Event Fund and were told they'll have more information at a later date. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
This is CICK News. Smithers Community Safety Officer Carl Chad spoke to me about a program launching this year in Smithers to mitigate bike theft and celebrate good bike behavior. Look out for Carl this spring and summer in his high-vis vest and tablet in hand on a bicycle, ready to register your bike in Project 529. Can you tell me a little bit about how this project made its way to Smithers? Because this obviously wasn't created here, but how did it make its way here?
Being that Smithers has an avid biking community, I was looking at resources in order to try and curb bike theft in town. And this was actually suggested to me by another biking enthusiast in town, and I looked into it and it seemed like a good platform, and I see that Terrace RCMP are also using it, so I thought we should bring it to town.
Explain it to me and our listeners. What is it?
So basically it's a registration system that where you can register your bike for free, and it goes on a national database, and any law enforcement agency, bike shop can search the registry and find out who the owner of the bike is and return it to them if it's stolen. There's also a decal that can be purchased for, I believe it's going to be about $7. And it's just like the license plate decals we used to have. They're really hard to take off once they're put on. And that decal is actually recognized by most thieves, and they usually try to bypass those bikes knowing how good the registry system works. The RCMP in town will be also having the app on their smartphones, so they can also help you register your bike and or search the bike for you.
If I go to an RCMP officer, I can ask them to help me. If I have a new bike, they will actually help me register
if they're not busy, yeah, and they want to, they can. I don't know how much they'll get involved in doing it, but there's also a couple bike shops in town, repair shops, that will hopefully be joining in with us.
You said that most thieves bypass those bikes. How would you know if most thieves bypass the bicycles with decals on them?
I talked to the project leaders of 529 and when I set it up, and they were telling me how well it was working. And then if you go on their website, you can see some stats.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have statistics on stolen and missing bikes in Smithers?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay.
But there will be, if you go on the website, so if you follow our smithers.ca, and you go into the website and find the Project 529 section, there will be updates eventually going on there. It'll show you how many bikes are registered, how many bikes have been stolen, and how many bikes have been recovered.
Project 529 Garage claims that cities that actively use their registration system have seen up to a 40% decline in bike theft. And according to thebestbikelock.com, a Canadian survey website designed to share bike theft statistics, over 54% of bikes stolen in Canada are taken from the garden, shed, or garage of the owner, and just 24% of stolen bikes are actually taken from the street. 80% of the bikes stolen from the street were locked, while 68% of bike theft victims in Canada did not have a record of the bike's frame number.
On the bottom of your bike, typically either on the steering stem or the very bottom by the crankshaft, there is a serial number. So you punch that serial number in, color, make, model, as much information as you can give. And if you buy the shield, it's called the little decal, it'll have its own number, which can also be put in.
Okay.
I'll be going around this summer and stopping people. We're going to implement what's called a positive ticketing program, which means if you're wearing your helmet properly, or I see you use your hand signals properly, we'll have basically a little coupon for you to go to a local vendor and get free coffee or something. To be honest with you, most bike recoveries happen at our level, at the bylaw enforcement level. And usually even when the RCMP sees a bike in a warrant or anything, that it always comes back to us to distribute. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a tool that we can use to get it back to its rightful owner. This is such an easy system to access to see who the bike belongs to. And if you sell the bike to somebody, it's super easy to transfer the name, and it just takes all the information and puts it into their name. So, and it doesn't cost anything to transfer the name as well.
What if someone steals the bike and then changes it under their name because they have the number?
They can't.
Why not?
Because when you register the bike, you have to do it, because you basically create a small account real quick under your name. So if they don't have the password, they can't change the registration.
If you want to register your bike today, you can go to project529.com and you can create an account and register there. Or you can go to smithers.ca and find a link to Project 529 there. Or leave it up to chance and maybe you'll get a free coffee out of it from Community Safety Officer Carl Chet. CSK News is made possible from the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Thanks for listening. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.